Okay, welcome back. So, I gave you four homework problems last time, so a lot to think about. One of you did come to my office hours already, asking about that, so that's good.
If anybody has it done already, and they want to turn it in today, great, and I'll try and get feedback to you as soon as possible. If you're not ready to turn it in yet, that's fine.
The homework I'm assigning today is just two problems.
Now, one thing to note is, if you read the syllabus carefully, it says something about tests. How do I choose problems for the tests? Anybody see that part in the syllabus?
From our homework.
Yes, from our homework and class examples.
It's definitely to your advantage to figure this stuff out, and then to let me tell you whether or not you got it right. Okay. So I put my outline, see if I can make it. I had more stuff planned for day one than what I actually did. Sometimes, you know, it's just
going through the details of some proof takes longer than I expect. Like that, talking about the proof of the irrationality of square root of 3, for example, took a long time. Now, then I'll just get started. Right? Don't want to run out of time. Okay. So
my hope is that you're getting into the swing of things with your classes and keeping up with all your readings. So hopefully most of you have read sections 1.3 and 1.4 by now. That's my hope. Okay, so let's look at number 8. And possibly augment it with something even simpler. 1.3 here. This is a question that doesn't ask for any proofs. It just, and it's very clear, compute without proofs the suprema and ultima if they exist. So this is on page 19. Exercise number 8 of section 1.3. So exercise 1.3.8. Now, let me do part C first. So the idea here is the supremum of the given set equals what, right? So if I call the set A, then what is its supremum and what is its infimum? So if I call set A this guy, okay. So this is in set builder notation. And so you've got N ranging over the natural numbers. So for all of those guys, you're going to divide by what? You're going to divide by 3 and plus 1, so starting at 1. So really the set we're talking about is 1, let's see, 3 times 1 is 3, plus 1 is 4. And then when n is 2, you have 3 times 2 plus 1, which is 7. And then when n is 3, you have a numerator of 3. And then 3 times 3 plus 1, which is 10. And now you're starting to get the idea here, right? 4, 3 times 4 plus 1 is 13. Okay. So if my set A is this thing, all those fractions that appear anywhere in that list, right, including the infinitely many in the dot, 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 right? Just continuing the pattern. What's the infimum? What's the supremum? there's a subtle difference between minimum and maximum and supremum and infimum. Might help to plot these on the number line. Let's see here. Plot a few of them, get an idea of what's going on here. Let's see here. You know, you remember how to compare fractions, right? Which is bigger? 1/4 or 2/7, right? 2/7 is bigger, right? Because 1 times 7 is smaller than 2 times 4. Cross-multiply and compare, right? And multiply both sides of this by 28. You get 7 on the left and 8 on the right. Because 4 times 7 is 28. However you do it, 1/4 is less than 2/7. And then you can compare again, right? 2 times 10 versus 7 times 3. 2/7 is less than 3/10. And keep going. This is an increasing sequence. They're not asking for a proof, so I think we'll just go of our gut here and believe that it's increasing. Okay, so what have we got? We've got 1/4 and 2/7, 3/10. And what's going to happen here? All of these things, so we have this increasing sequence. So, what do you think happens if you pick something really late in the sequence? Is it going to be really big, like it's going off to infinity, or does it have a limit? Right? Or what's going on? Just if you had to make a guess,
okay.
Get close to one. Well, let's think
about that. What if I had this? How about let's try 1,000, right? So 3 times 1,000 plus 1. That's an A. And there's other numbers, right? What else is an A? We could go bigger, right? How about 1,000,000? 3 times 1,000,000 plus 1. That's also an A. What are these close to?
1/3.
They're close to 1/3. I mean, you can prove that, it's just like finding a horizontal asymptote that happens, but we don't need a proof here. If you wanted to do a calculus-style argument, which we can't quite justify yet, given all the things we haven't really proved yet, you just divide the top and bottom by n, right? And that goes to 1 over 3 plus 0. You play that game, right?
And you make n large.
So, from what I remember from calculus
about sequences and horizontal asymptotes of functions,
I know, I really think it's going to 1/3, and plugging in some large numbers seems to confirm that, right? Now here's a question, though. So they're close to 1/3. Yeah? But close from which way? If I have this guy, 1,000 over 3,001, is it less than 1/3? Greater than 1/3? Which one?
It's less than 1/3.
It's less than. Okay. So we have this increasing sequence, and it's getting close to 1/3, but from below. I mean, you can prove it in general, right? But again, they're not asking for a proof of it. Yeah.
Just said round down the denominator a little bit, hence round up the fraction.
So, you know, this big thing here is it's piling up, so to speak, right? The numbers, they keep increasing, right? I think we're going to trust our gut here that these numbers keep increasing. So they're all different from each other, yet they're all getting close to a third. So they must be getting really crowded there, right? And somehow they get close to a third. Okay? So they're just kind of piling up. And now I think you can tell me the answers. Okay, so what is the supremum of this set?
One third,
right? The supremum is the what kind of upper bound? Least upper bound, right? So you've got all this stuff, right? All this stuff from one third all the way to infinity. Those are all upper bounds of A, right? Because everything that you've got here in A is all below a third. Anything that's a third or higher is an upper bound. Okay? And so the least upper bound is a third. The way I think about it is that I've got all the stuff above A, and then I imagine I jump out of a plane on the number line, I take the parachute until I crash into A, right? Where do I crash into A? Right at one third. If I go any lower than a third, I'm going to get under some of these numbers, right? Because we know that in the limit they go to a third. So there's no room for me to go lower about crashing into some stuff in A. And so we have our fancy Latin word of supremum, which gets abbreviated sup or soup, right? The supremum of A. Okay. Okay. And then the infimum is the other thing, right?
But I guess, are there any questions about the supremum part? Okay, so turn it around, go the other way.
All right, so now think about this. Clearly, all the lower bounds of A are right here, right? All the stuff below A. Right? Everything up to and including a fourth is a lower bound. Okay? So one third is the supremum, and one fourth is the infimum, the greatest lower bound. Okay. So you can think of it as you want to
squeeze things down, find the smallest interval that contains A,
and that interval is the one that goes from a fourth to a third. If you try and go any higher than a fourth here, you're going to lose something in A, namely a fourth itself. If you try and go any lower than a third here, you're going to lose some of these numbers that are really close to a third, right? Because if you drop this down by, I don't know, a hundredth, right, 0.01, there's some numbers here less than a hundredth away from a third. So you can't drop it down. You can't drop it down a millionth either, because there's some numbers in here closer than a millionth to a third. You just can't drop it down at all. A third is as low as you can go, and a fourth is as high as you can go if you want to sandwich this thing in here. Right? So if you're coming up the number line, you're going to crash into A at a fourth. If you're coming down the number line, you're going to crash into A at a third. Okay. So that solves that one. And then a little, by the way, that minimum means the least element of A, right? 1/4 is also the minimum.
Because that's the lowest number in A.
What's the maximum of A?
No. Why is the maximum not a third? You can't reach it. What does that mean, we can't reach it? Is 1/3 in A?
There's no value of M that makes that.
Yeah, 1/3 is touches A, right?
You've got all these things in A, and 1/3 touches A, right? You've got stuff in A that's as close as you want to a third. But a third is not in A, right? There is no maximum. Because for any number in A, there's always another number a little higher. There's always something greater in A. Namely, just take the next step, right? So, the next thing in the sequence is actually greater. There's always something higher. Okay, I didn't prove that little thing there, but
we sort of saw the pattern, right? The 1/4 is less than the 2/7, the 2/7 is less than the 3/10, and you can prove that by cross multiplying, right?
So you could cross multiply here, and you could check that n times the quantity 3 times n plus 1, all plus 1, is less than 3n plus 1 times n plus 1, right?
Yeah. But again,
this question didn't ask for a proof, right? If it did, I could have done it, right?
Yeah. Except for some parts about that limit of 1 over n, right? That you need 1.4 stuff, not 1.3 stuff.
And the Archimedean property. But I wanted here to really bring out the concept of what is an infimum, what is a supremum, and how are they different from minima and maxima?
Okay.
Let's see. So that was part C. Maybe we can do one more of these. We should move on. So, any requests? Part A, part B, or part D of number 8 in section 1.3? D. Okay. So if you didn't bring your book today, you can see that it would be helpful to bring your book in the future, right? Okay. So again, there's a set. I want the greatest lower bound and the least upper bound, if they exist,
of the following sets. And I'm calling the set A here to make
life a little easier when I solve the problem.
The book doesn't actually name the sets with symbols, but
you can always introduce one,
right,
if that helps you. Okay. So first of all, if you're not familiar with this kind of notation, you might not even know what A is supposed to be.
Okay. Well, let's clarify that. Okay. So I can pick any two natural numbers I want, right? That's what this colon, and then for M and N in the big bold capital N there, that's the natural numbers. Right. And then I apply this function to it, the function where the inputs are these two variables and the output is that fraction. Okay? So let's think of pairs of natural numbers. Well, it could be 1 and 1, right? There's no rule that, it doesn't say there M and N have to be different, just any two natural numbers.
Okay.
So I could use 1 and 1. I could use 1 and 2 for that matter. But I could also use 2 and 1. And I could use 2 and 2. And then I could do stuff involving 3s, right? I could do 1 and 3. I could do 3 and 1. And I could also do 2 and 3, right? And hence I could do 3 and 2. And I could do 3 and 3. And then I think that's all the stuff I could do involving numbers 3 or smaller, right?
You'll notice I've listed 9 numbers so far, and 3 squared is 9. That's not a coincidence, right? Because there's 9 pairs of things you can choose from the numbers 1, 2, 3.
9 ordered pairs, right? 1, 3 is different than 3, 1. Okay, so this just keeps going on forever, right? If I bring in the number 4 as allowed, then I'd get 7 more fractions, and now my list is 16 long, and then so on. It's just going to keep going. Let's see. So we're trying to imagine what this looks like on the number line now.
Can I say anything about this? I mean, can you think of any upper bounds or any lower bounds for this stuff? Can this stuff go up as high as I want? Can it go down as low as I want? Any bounds on? What about one? Is that a bound?
Yeah.
An upper bound?
Yep. Yeah. 1/2 would be a lower bound. Lower bound would keep going infinitely.
We'll think about that. Okay, so yeah, I agree that 1 is an upper bound. Okay, and hence everything above 1 is an upper bound, and then. And then I'm not sure. What about stuff below 1? I'll have to think about that. I'm not sure about 1/2 being a lower bound. Okay, so we've got stuff in A.
What about 0?
0? Yeah. All of these are positive. Okay, so let's see. Okay, there's 0. Okay, so I've got some lower bounds. Everything that's 0 or less is definitely a lower bound, right? Because those are always positive. All right? And so, but are there, there's the question is, are there more lower bounds, or is 0 the best I can do? All right. Same question regarding 1, right? I know there's stuff between 0 and 1 in A. But how high does that stuff go? Does A touch 1? And going down here, does A touch 0?
Or can I say something a little better, like A is always above 1/10? Or 1/10 is the lowest thing in A? What can I say? And same with 1, right? Can I get as close as I want to 1?
Or is there some number here like 999 out of 1,000 and nothing is greater than that in A?
I think you can keep getting close to both bounds.
Okay.
Because of the fact that where N can be any natural number, you could make M 1 over 1 plus a million if you wanted to.
Well, M's got to be a natural number too.
Yeah.
Are you saying like make M be...
No, like, yeah, M has to be a natural number, which 1 is a natural number, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So if it was 1 over 1 plus, and then it doesn't say that N has to be close to M. So if N was a million,
yes,
it
I
would
get
be
it.
1 over a million and 1.
Okay.
Excellent argument.
And then the same thing goes vice versa, because you could have M as a million and N as 1, so it'd be a million over... A million and one.
Very good.
Excellent reasoning. Okay. So you can get as close to zero and as close to one as you want, right? You know, if a one over a million is not small enough a distance for you, make it billions, trillions, whatever, right?
Okay.
Okay.
So, with that part there, we've really got it, right?
So, zero really is the infimum, and one really is the supremum. So let's think about kind of the order of reasoning here. So what was our first step? Step number one, I guess, was figuring out that A was stuck between zero and one. And then step number two was asking, can we do any better than that? Can we squeeze A between, squeeze A into a smaller interval, right? Or does A really need to go all the way from 0 to 1, right?
Do I crash into it at 0 from below and crash into it 1 at above?
And then our step three here was this guy, this pair of arguments here that, no, I can get as close to zero as I want. I can get as close to one as I want. And so that told me that, no, I can't do any better than bounds of zero and one. So zero is the greatest lower bound, or infimum, and one is the least upper bound, or supremum. And yeah, I guess if you wanted to have an earlier step, it would have been step zero, where you understood what the notation means, right?
Okay. Questions or comments about this one? And what's the minimum of this last set A?
There is no minimum,
right? You can get close to zero, as close as you want, but zero itself is not an A.
And what's the maximum?
There is none, right?
You can get close to one in A, but one itself is not an A. So, suprema and infima, but no maximum. Calculator that's older than some of you. Not sure the camera's older than anything. And in 10 years, you know, if I still have this thing, it probably will be older than the students. All right.
Yeah, again, with this question here, it didn't ask for a proof, so I didn't try and write out a nice little essay for you, right? I just figured stuff out. There are some supremum and infimum proofs in the textbook. Okay. So we'll talk about making that stuff a little bit more formal as we go on. Okay.
Axiom of completeness. Is a way of capturing how the real numbers are better than the rational numbers. And the reason I brought in all the suprema and infima is that the way this author states this axiom is using suprema and infima. There are other ways to state this axiom in the sense that you can prove that if you accept version A of the axiom, then version B is true. Or if you accept version B of the axiom, then version A is true. So they're logically equivalent. But I'm going to use the version this author picked. And if you ever read about another version on the internet or another book, they're logically equivalent. You can use one to prove the other. Okay. So if I have a subset of the reals, right? So I have some reals, right? Could be a really complicated subset, but the idea is the set of upper bounds is not complicated. Right? If it has an upper bound, then it has a least upper bound. The idea is, okay, I've got my stuff here in A, right? However complicated A is, and then I've got my upper bounds of A. And there's one little caveat here. If A was the empty set, then this would all be kind of stupid because everything would be an upper bound of A. So you'd go all the way down to negative infinity looking for the least upper bound. So A is not empty, right? Okay. Not the empty set, right? Okay. So
should that be aligned under the subset symbol? Is that a proper subset or?
It doesn't have to be. Proper.
I think in this textbook it doesn't have to be underlined.
But the fact that it has an upper bound will force it to be proper in this particular example. So if all that stuff, then the supremum of A exists, right? Or in less technical language, right? NA has a least upper bound. And we call that thing the supremum of A, right? As the book explains, if you have one least upper bound, then that you can't have another one, right? Among all your upper bounds, only one of them can be the least, right? Okay, so the idea is the set of upper bounds is actually pretty simple. It's a ray that starts somewhere and goes off to infinity. And it has to start somewhere, right? If there was nothing there, right? If A kind of touched a point on the line, except there was no point on the line there, right? I feel like there was a hole, right?
compare to the rationals, right? We have the following situation. This is a nice example in the book, right? There's a set T, set of all rationals, where, actually, I think they use T for the one in the wheels. Anyways, here. Say I have A be the set of all rational numbers where Q squared is less than 2. Then you've got bounds like 1.5 and negative 1.5 above and below, right? Q has to be smaller than 1.5 squares less than 2. And you've got a whole bunch of upper bounds as well, right? Not just 1.5, but also 1.43 and others, right? And then you've got a whole bunch of lower bounds. But you've got a problem right here, because the square root of 2 is not rational. You've got a problem right here. Negative root 2 is also not rational. So you've got holes, right? Intuitively, okay, I'm just going to come at this set from above of rational numbers with squares smaller than 2. I'm going to hit it somewhere. But if you try that with the rational line, you fall into a hole with root 2 because it's missing. Or if you try and crash into it from below, you fall into a hole at negative root 2. It's missing. The real line fills in all the holes. Right?
There's no hole at root 2 or root 3 or at e or pi or any of those other irrational numbers.
And so this statement here, right, that's the axiom of completeness. Since we're calling it an axiom, that means we are assuming it, right? We're not going to prove it, we're going to assume it.
Whatever the real number line is, which this course doesn't precisely define because that takes too long, we're going to assume that whatever our concept of the real number line is, it does not have holes. And the precise way of stating that for us will be that if a set has an upper bound, then it's got a supremum. There's no hole, unlike with the rationals.
So there will be lots of things where, say you want to prove a certain thing, you'll end up needing to use this axiom, because if it's anything that's, say it's true about the reals, but not the rationals, what's the difference between these two? This axiom. So there will be situations where you need to prove something not true of the rationals, but true of the reals. And so that axiom will come into play somewhere. Either you use it directly, or the axiom gets used to prove some lemma or theorem, and then you use that lemma or theorem to help you do your proof. Yeah. In calculus, there's things like the intermediate value theorem, right? If you have a continuous function and here it's negative, and then over here the graph goes up to be positive, somewhere in between the function is zero, right? Can't prove that about the rationals. Just use the function x squared minus 2, counterexample. You have to use, if not directly, at least indirectly, somewhere you're using the axiom of completeness if you actually want to prove the intermediate value theorem.
Now, later in the book, that theorem is proved. Right?
But you have to have some formally stated, in mathematical language like this, we're talking about sets and upper bounds here, you have to have some kind of precise statement of what you're assuming about the real line before you can actually prove stuff like that.
You also need a precise definition of what is a continuous function. We'll get to that later in the course as well.
I wanted to do another example of how you can actually prove stuff involving suprema and infima. So I wanted to look at this exercise, number 6, part D.
This is an example where you have to prove something, and you're going to use lemma 1.38. And so I'll remind you what lemma 1.3.8 is in a minute. And here's the question for part D. Okay, given S is the supremum of A, and T is the supremum of B, and then given another set which is called A plus B, how do I add sets? It's not a union, it's something a little different. It's kind of like part D of that previous exercise, where you take any two things and you combine them in a certain way. So in this case, you take any two things, provided the first thing is from A, and the second thing is from B. So take anything from the first set, and take anything you want from the second set, and add them together. And A and B might be infinite sets, so there might be infinitely many possible pairs of little a and little b that you could pick. And then add them all up together, right? So, for example, if I took everything from 0 to 5, not including 5, and I added it to, say, everything from 3 to 4, including the endpoints, what kind of stuff could I get? Well, I claim the least thing I can get is 0 plus 3. So, 3. And I could get close to 9, right? I could pick something close to 5 and add 4 to it. But I won't quite get all the way to 9, right? Because I can't do exactly 5 plus 4. So that's what would happen if I can pick whatever I want from 0 to 5, except 5. And then I pick whatever I want from 3 to 4, and then add it. I can get anything from 3 to 9, except maybe 9. Well, except, yeah, definitely except 9. I can't get 9.
Okay, and so I'm given all this stuff, right? And then we're asked to prove something here. If you look at part C, it says show that the supremum of the sum set, A plus B, so that set, just to find there, prove that that's the sum of the suprema, the S and T. Okay? So I've got S, and I've got T, and I've got my stuff in A, I've got my stuff in B. You crash into A from above it, S, you crash into B from above it, T. And then somehow we're trying to imagine whatever this crazy set is, where I add up everything in A and B, and then we're hoping, and we're trying to prove that we're going to crash into it at S plus T. Mm-hmm. We haven't proved that yet, so I'll put a question mark. Okay. And it says, using lemma 1.3.8. Okay. Okay. So what is that? Well, that is a lemma that makes it easier to prove stuff about suprema. It says, assume S in R is an upper bound of a set A contained in R. You know, John, I think this book does underline the subset relation. I don't, but I will underline it because the book does. There. Okay. Sorry, I misremembered that.
Okay. I'll try and stick to that. I try to be consistent with the book in each of my courses. Anyways, okay. So, lemma 1.3.8. Okay. Then, given an upper bound, S of a set A, S is supreme of A, if and only if, for every choice of positive epsilon, there's an element A in A satisfying S minus epsilon less than A.
Now, one thing about actually using a lemma here is that when that lemma was stated, it said, let S be an upper bound of a set A. Right? Now, you don't want to necessarily have that be the same S and A as in this problem, right? S and A for that lemma could be whatever you want. So to emphasize that, let me state lemma 1.3.8 without using the same letters, right? You can change the letters, but it doesn't change the meaning, right? So assume X in the reals, right, is an upper bound for a set C, subset of the reals. Then X is equal to the supremum of C if and only if for every choice of the epsilon is not conflicting with what we're doing here. For every choice of epsilon positive, there exists an element a, little a in big A satisfying, so I'll just write with because that's a shorter word for the same thing, with S minus epsilon less than A. Okay? And there's a very big, not little A. Yeah. And then not S, right? X. Okay, so my transcription ran into some problems there. How about Y? Okay? So there exists Y in C with X minus epsilon less than Y. You want to understand that, you really should make a picture, I think. Right? So, okay, I've got a bunch of stuff that's in C. And then what does X equal the supremum of C look like? Okay, so I've got X. That's where I hit C. And then it's an upper bound. So to be the least upper bound, that means I can't go any lower. And so now we can make sense of this. We have, okay, here's, say, X minus epsilon. For any positive epsilon, that would be lower. But we just said we can't go lower and still be an upper bound if we're talking about the supremum. So the idea is, okay, you've got all your stuff in Y, or sorry, all your stuff in C, including this Y here. So for every X, or not for every X, for every epsilon, you should be able to argue that X minus epsilon doesn't work. There should be a counterexample to it being an upper bound. Right? We come at this set from above, and we crash into it at X. If we try to go lower to some X minus epsilon, we must be running over some stuff in the set. Okay? So whatever epsilon you try, there's going to be some number Y in the set that you ran over. Can't go that low. So that's the idea. So I want to apply it over here. Okay? So my thinking is, okay, I've got this guy X, and I've got this other guy C. So, and this looks kind of nice, right? I'm trying to prove something as the supremum of something. So I'm just doing a little pattern matching here. Let's make that be the C, the A plus B there. And let's make this be the X, right? Okay.
Okay.
Great.
So, to use this in the proof now, what do I need? Well, I can't use it if the assumption doesn't hold. So my little x, my s plus t, had better be an upper bound for my c, my a plus b. And it is.
Okay.
For all a in big A and b in big B,
what do we have? We know that S is a least upper bound of A, so in particular, it's an upper bound. So A is at most S, right? I've got my little A in here. I've got my little B in here somewhere, right? Okay. Now just add those. So A plus B is less than S plus T. So just add the inequality. So somewhere over here, you've got your A plus B. Right?
Your little a plus your little b, right? Inside the big set
a plus b. Right? Okay.
Yeah, I should have done all this.
Thanks. There it is. Okay. So S plus T is an upper bound, because if you add anything from big A and anything from big B, which is how you create all the stuff in set A plus B, right, it's going to be less than or equal to the sum of these upper bounds of big A and big B. So this part right here is necessary. I need to have this assumption valid. Okay. I just proved that I do have an upper bound, so I've met my assumption here. So now I can apply lemma 1.38.
How do I apply it?
I'm going to do something with the epsilons, right? Take stock here, right? I was told to use this lemma, so the first step in using it is finding something that satisfies the assumptions of the lemma, and I did. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay, now the question is, did I pick the right things, right? I picked an X and C to hit with this lemma. Is S plus T and A plus B the right X and the right C? Well, the only way to find out is to try. So let's see if I picked right. Maybe it's something more complicated where you have to use the lemma twice or three times. Who knows? But let's try the simplest thing first, right? That's my thinking process here. The simplest thing I could do is use those two sets for the lemma. All right. Now, epsilons, epsilons, epsilons. Okay. So here's how I use lemma 1.38. So by lemma 1.38, it says that being the supremum under our assumptions, being the supremum is the same as having this property. For every positive epsilon, you've got blah, blah, blah. Okay, so if I can just prove this epsilon statement here, then I've proved the supremum equation that I want. Okay.
It's an if and only if, so the two things are logically equivalent. So I'm using one direction of that. So how do I prove something about all positive epsilon? I can't check them all one by one. So what I do is I just say, okay, let's assume I've got a mystery positive epsilon. I don't know anything about this guy. He's on the other side of a closed door. I don't know anything about him except he's positive. And I'm going to prove that we get what we want without assuming anything about the epsilon except it's positive. And so my one argument will work for any positive epsilon. Okay. So I assume I've got an epsilon, but I don't assume anything except what I'm allowed to assume, which is that it's positive. But given an epsilon positive, right, that's how I'm going to prove for every choice of epsilon. I'm just going to, okay, let's say somebody chose one for me. Given some epsilon I know nothing about other than positivity, it's enough to find what is needed, right? It's enough to find some number y in our set, which is for us a plus b, with x minus epsilon, well, for us s plus t minus epsilon, less than y. So I just plugged in there. X, and you've got other stuff as well, right? It's enough to say, okay, that's what we need to do, but how do we do it? Where am I going to find this y? Somebody gives me the mystery epsilon. They won't tell me anything about it except it's positive, and now I've got to come up with this number y? How am I going to do that?
Assume that y is little a plus
little b? It's going to have to be of that form, right? There has to be some little a from big A and a little b from big B that we pick and add together to get the y. Okay. But, so how do we pick the little a and the little b to make this work? Okay.
Let's make a picture of our situation here. S, T, S plus T, here's S plus T minus epsilon. We want to find our little y equal to some A plus B in between, right? Strictly bigger than S plus T minus epsilon. So we're going to need to pick some A and some B. Little a and little b, right? How could I pick them? How do I make sure that the little a and little b are high enough that my y is high enough? Right?
How can I be sure that I can find such little a and little b? Totally different set, right? The idea is to use the other half of the lemma, right? The lemma says that you can go both ways. It's an if and only if. So I have over here a supremum statement or a supremum equation. So I can actually use that over here. And use it to get an epsilon statement. Okay. So, to make it clear, think about this. If epsilon was, say, 1 over 10, right, a tenth, if you could get the A within a 20th of S and the T within a 20th of B, then you could get the A plus B within a tenth, right? Like, if you're a 20th close here and a 20th close here, then the distance here adds up to, like a tenth, right? So how about we do that? Let's use, in general, instead of half of a tenth, which is a 20th, use half of epsilon. So if you want, you can explicitly make up that. Okay, this is positive. Just divide your positive epsilon by 2. Now we use lemma 1.38 again, but now in a different way. Okay? We already know two supremum equations, these two. Okay? We don't know this one yet. We haven't proved the supremum of A plus B is S plus T yet. But we're given two supremum equations, and since this lemma is an if and only if, we can use that here, right? And we're not going to use epsilon, though. We're going to use delta, right? So here's my epsilon positive. But I'm not going to use that positive number that was given to me here. I'm going to use this other positive number that I chose based on the earlier epsilon, which I didn't have freedom to choose. Right? I think of this as the adversary gave me the epsilon here, and I have to do this proof. I have to cook up the y that my challenger epsilon is demanding of me. But now I'm in the other role here. Now I'm the challenger here, so I can say, oh, you think the supremum of A is S? Well, here's my positive number. In this case, epsilon over 2. Now you give me that kind of Y that's supposed to exist. Okay? So we're going to have S minus delta and T minus delta. So we're applying it to our delta. Okay? So there are A in capital A and B in capital B with exactly the inequalities we need now. With A greater than S minus delta, and with B greater than T minus delta. So I'm using the other half of lemma 1.38. So, so
So this is the y we want, or at least it's one of the y's that will work for us. Y, if we define it to be a plus b, little a plus little b, then by definition of capital A plus capital B, it's in that set. And if you add these two inequalities, you get that S plus T minus 2 delta is less than A plus B, which is Y. But 2 delta is epsilon. Okay? And
we can put a little box on it, right?
It's done now. We proved what we need to prove.
The law proofs can go like this. You have some tool like the lemma, and you can think of it as a machine. You put in something, and then it gives you something in return. And this machine, you could reverse the direction on it, right? You could put in a supremum equation, and you could get out this epsilon statement for any epsilon you put in, as long as it's positive. Or you could turn the machine around, and you could have an upper bound, and then you have some general argument that proves all these epsilon statements with one unifying argument. And then what does it spit out? The supremum equation.
So that was how I was able to reduce our desired supremum equation to a collection of epsilon statements that I had to prove for arbitrary positive epsilon. And then to prove those, I put the machine in the other direction and fed in some supremum statements and a very well-chosen positive number for the epsilon. I called it delta to get out with.
And if you think about it, there's only so many things you have here, right?
You have the two supremum equations, you have A plus B, and you could obviously add S plus B, and you were told to use this lemma. So there's only so many things you can try to make a proof here. So I gave you the kind of the garden path in that, more like the royal road in which I didn't give you a bunch of wrong guesses. I mean, I
showed you the things that would work. But even if I or you had made some wrong guesses, there weren't that many other things you could try here. Right? There's only so many ways you could use this lemma, given the inputs you had. So, if I took that proof too slow for you, my apologies. But I didn't want to go too fast, at least not when it's relatively new.
You may want to try, revisiting this sometime after class. I mean, you can go and read through the argument, right? See it again. You can read through similar arguments in the book. Questions about this little proof we did here? Okay.
So in the last 3 minutes, I will just say briefly that...
You want to look at section 1.4. Look at these guys here. What do these theorems say? Right? They say some nice stuff.
The one most relevant to the exercise 1.4 number 8 that I assigned is theorem 1.4.1. Nested interval property, because that exercise is asking you to look at some variations on that.
Look at how things are proved. Look at the proof of theorem 1.4.1 when you're trying to prove exercise 8. Clue how to start this exercise, look at the proofs in the section that the exercise came from. That might give you some ideas for how to cook up your own proof. How do they use the axiom of completeness and all those nice theorems there
that say nice stuff like essentially the limit of 1 over n really is 0, and between any two real numbers there really is a rational number. Right? How do you prove that straight from the axiom of completeness?
What kind of stuff is that? Okay.
Any last questions? All right, we finished on time.